From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. Later in the broadcast, we'll explore how politics of the partisan and petty variety affects the look and feel of the district. But first, the Republican primary for the at-large seat on the D.C. Council. In a city where registered Democrats outnumber Republicans 10 to 1, D.C. politics often looks like a one-party show. So why is one of the most interesting races on the GOP side? September 9th is primary day, pitting five-term Republican Councilwoman Carol Schwartz against a relative newcomer, Patrick Mara. They join us to discuss the challenges and opportunities of being a red candidate in a blue town. Patrick Mara, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
Carol Schwartz is a council member at large and chairperson of the Committee on Workforce Development and Government Operations. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Kojo, and I'm actually seeking my fifth term.
You're seeking your fifth term. You're not council member emeritus. You're not ordained. You're not queen of the
city
council.
Yeah, I really thought that it wasn't quite fair because I always run for election and I've not ever been ordained anything and expect to be ordained. I work hard and I run hard and I ask people to vote for me based on my record and a good campaign.
We just wanted to clear that up. But each of you now has 60 seconds to make an opening statement. First you, the challenger, Patrick Mara.
Thanks, Kojo. First of all, thanks again for having me here today on your show. I really appreciate this opportunity because, to be honest with you, this is the first time we've had the chance to get together and debate our differences in front of the public. What I'm offering voters is the opportunity for a choice in the Republican primary for the first time in years. And I'm offering Ms. Schwartz her most competitive primary challenge that she's ever had. I'm offering those voters a chance for a change. I'm running to restore fiscal responsibility to the D.C. government. The budget is up 51% in the past 4 years. This is a problem that must end. I'm also the only candidate in any city council race to sign the Taxpayer Protection Pledge, which states that I will not vote for any new or increased taxes.
10 seconds.
I'm also running to help the mayor with the reform of the schools. This is probably the most important issue facing us today.
And now the incumbent, Carol Schwartz.
Well, thank you, Kojo, for giving us an opportunity to be here. And actually, we did have a chance to debate the public last night at the Fair Budget Coalition meeting, and my opponent did not show. So I guess he likes the big media events, not necessarily when you're out there just with the people. But I am running for re-election because I think we need to maintain our financial stability, which I helped bring us since I came back to the council in 1997. You may recall, Kojo, that when I was there from 85 to 89, I voted against the bloated bureaucratic budgets that were presented to me. And I did so because out of fear that we would go bankrupt. And I warned my colleagues that that could happen. I left following the death of my husband, and I was gone for 8 years. And when I came back, that was after the city had gone bankrupt. The control board came in, and I have been very much a part of bringing us fiscal stability and 10 years of balanced budgets.
Carol Schwartz is the incumbent. The challenger is Patrick Mara. Patrick Mara, allow me to begin with you. You don't have much of a known political history in the District of Columbia yet. Going over your campaign finances, many people have noted that there are lots of so-called downtown interests who have contributed to your campaign. You've been endorsed both by the Board of Trade and the D.C. Chamber of Commerce. If you were to become the at-large council member, wouldn't you be beholden to those interests? That's clearly who supports you.
No, sir. The way I'm running my campaign is on message. I'm primarily talking about a message in which D.C. residents are overtaxed, and we all know that. D.C. small businesses are overtaxed and overregulated, and we all know that. And this is a problem that's gone on for years and years. Every day I meet young professionals, middle-aged professionals who are looking to move to Virginia or Maryland based on these issues of taxes being too high, based on the city services not being up to where they should for the taxes they pay.
But you're running against the author of the school shopping tax holiday. How do you attack your opponent on the basis of taxes?
Sure. Well, that's, you know, it's fine to be Republican for 1 week out of the year with a sales tax holiday, but you need to take a more comprehensive approach to taxes. And we're going to continue to see folks leave the district. Let me give you an example. I visited thousands of Republican homes in the past couple months. In the past 2 weeks alone, I've met five couples who will move to Virginia in the next 6 to 9 months based on taxes.
Because of high taxes in the District of Columbia. Councilmember Schwartz, how do you defend your record on the issue of taxes?
Well, it's just so incongruous that I'm being attacked at being a tax and spend person when actually my whole reputation has been totally the opposite. If you ask any member of the council, I have been, or any member of the public, a leader in cutting taxes. When I was there in the 80s, the only two tax relief packages came from me, lowering the inheritance tax to be similar to jurisdictions around the country, as well as lowering the income tax. I also, when I came back on the council in 97, I introduced the Tax Reduction Amendment Act in March of 1999, which led to the Tax Parity Act, which I was a co-introducer of. And since that time, I have co-introduced, co-sponsored many areas of tax relief. As you mentioned, the tax-free holiday, the Estate and Inheritance Tax Recoupling Act is mine, the Small Business Commercial Property Tax relief. I was a co-sponsor, the owner-occupied residential tax credit, the pension and other retirement income exclusion from income tax, and I could keep you here for an hour. I don't know what my opponent is talking about. He does say he's, you know, like, I want you to know I've been unanimously, and he came into this race a little before I did, I've been unanimously endorsed by the D.C. Republican Committee. I was unanimously endorsed by the Log Cabin Republicans, and also I want to point out that only 6.4% of his money has come from registered Republicans, and 70% is special interest money.
Councilmember Schwartz, you mentioned who you've been endorsed by, including the D.C. Republican Party. Nevertheless, you have loaned your own campaign $40,000. Why?
I always do that, Kojo, because I don't like to raise money before I announce. And I usually don't announce too late because that means spending money. It means office space. And I don't like, because I don't want to be beholden to all these special interest groups.
How much of your money comes from registered Republicans?
Probably a huge portion. I've not looked. Actually, I didn't even do his numbers. Somebody else did them and gave them to me. A large number, and there are small donations from Republicans all over the city, but I'll be glad to call in at your next program and get back to you with those numbers. But yeah. I've also been endorsed by the Hotel Association, D.C., the Washington Hotel Association, and the Fraternal Order of Police, the Firefighters.
And four local SEIU unions.
Yes.
Patrick Merrow, Carol Schwartz helped to get a bill guaranteeing sick leave for private sector workers in the District of Columbia passed, the so-called Sick and Safe Leave Bill that apparently antagonized a lot of people in the business community. Nevertheless, the City Council voted on that bill 13-0. Were you on the council, how would you have voted?
Kojo, I would have voted against Sick and Safe. The businesses, the small businesses in particular in the District of Columbia, are overtaxed and overregulated. With that new legislation, with that new law, we're also discouraging new entrepreneurs from entering into the district. They're more likely to go to Virginia, which, or Maryland. Virginia, as you know, is now the business center and the population center of the D.C. metro area. But to respond to a few of the things that my opponent said, first off, this Tax Parity Act, she always takes credit for. This is legislation that Mr. Evans and Mr. Catania worked on. They wrote the whole thing. She simply co-sponsored it. And if you listen to how she talked about all the other tax legislation, it was co-sponsor, co-sponsor, co-sponsor. The bulk of her tax legislation was in the 80s. Now, when we look at the D.C. GOP unanimous endorsement, that was something that was done very quickly, very abruptly, to try and force me out of the race.
Why would the Republican Party, your own party, want to force you out of the race?
They were afraid that I would beat Ms. Schwartz, who is a part of this inside group. Now, but if I could just finish, though, the DC GOP, since that point, at least 20 members are now supporting me who are part of the internal DCRC. Just last week, I went to 3 DC GOP events. My opponent wasn't there, and folks were turning around and supporting me in droves. Looking at our hotel association endorsement, well, that's, you know, that's nice, but you know what? Marriott has pulled away from that endorsement. That's 30% of the hotels in D.C., and I'm sure we'll see more. And looking at
allow me to give out the phone number so we can take calls from our listeners. 800-433-8850 is the number to call if you'd like to join this conversation. You can also send email to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. If I can get back to the sick and safe leave bill for just one second.
Sure.
You said you would vote against it. That would mean, A, that there would have been a 12-1 vote on the council, thereby stamping you as a loser, or B, you would have been able to persuade the other 12 members of the council to go the other way. What makes you think you would have been able to do that?
Well, first of all, I would be in Ms. Schwartz's seat, so I wouldn't have shepherded the bill through. As you know, this is the only other place we have this is in San Francisco. So this is a very unusual provision to force upon, to mandate upon employers. It would be 12-1, and I anticipate, as a member of the council, there will be several votes where there will be 12-1 votes. One of the reasons I got into this race is I went to the D.C. Council homepage, and I just looked at all the voice votes, which are votes that are just unanimous consent votes, and all the 13-0 votes that are taken. And my opponent is a part of this rubber stamp mentality of the D.C. Council.
Well, I guess she would say that she is simply a part of a unanimous vote, or a majority of the vote. But Carol Schwartz, on the issue of voting rights for the District of Columbia, you are a member of a party, the National Party, of which does not generally support voting rights for the District of Columbia. Why do you?
Oh, I've always been a big activist in trying to get us voting rights, and I have participated in every single time we've been up on the Hill to lobby for voting rights, and every single time we've had a press conference about it. And I've never seen my opponent ever. I never even met my opponent until this election. And
where do you stand on voting rights, Mr. Mayor?
I am for a vote in the House of Representatives. I'm a member of D.C. Vote. And, you know, just look at this past January, my opponent had an opportunity to go up to New Hampshire and lobby the New Hampshire legislature for a right to vote, and she did not go.
You are going to the Republican National Convention this year in St. Paul. Is voting rights for the District of Columbia an issue that you will raise at that convention?
I've actually already volunteered with DC Vote to staff their table there.
Okay.
And I'm willing to do anything that they need at the convention.
I just was down at my own expense to the National Association of State Legislatures, where I worked the booth for days trying to get state legislatures to sign on to voting rights. Actually, the trip to New Hampshire, if you read the resolution, it was actually trying to defeat members who did not vote for voting rights. And it was a very partisan thing. So I did not participate in that, because I don't think we should. I think we need to be making more friends than enemies.
We're talking with D.C. Council Member Carol Schwartz. She is the incumbent, the Republican on the City Council in the at-large seat. She's chairperson of the Committee on Workforce Development and Government Operations. Her primary opponent is Patrick Mara, who also joins us in the studio. Allow me to go to the telephones. Here's Natalie in Washington. Natalie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Carol Schwartz. This is Natalie Mara, and I'm delighted that you're running again. My question to you is, what would you or what do you believe are the two primary issues in the district that you would like to...
You identified yourself as Natalie Mara. Are you any relative of Patrick Mara?
No, I'm not. I'm a double R.A.
And you're asking Carol Schwartz what she believes are the two most important issues facing the district?
Yes.
Well, I think fiscal stability, because if we don't have a balanced budget and fiscal financial stability, we can't afford to do anything. And so that's what happened to us in the 90s when I wasn't on the council. I think education, trying to improve our education system, and gosh, I hate to only have two. Also, I think jobs, job training for our residents since
I have a solution there.
Order you, to get them employed.
If you go to our website at kojoshow.org, you will see the issues that both of these candidates list as among their more important issues. And Patrick Mara, the reason I asked you the question about voting rights is that you did not list that as one of the more important issues. Obviously, you support it, but you don't think it's one of the more important issues facing the District of Columbia?
I do believe it's one of the more important issues, but I think that what we have happening now in the schools is the most important issue. I wholeheartedly support the mayor's take over the schools and would do everything and anything to assist the mayor in what he needs to get done to reform the schools. And
well, you sound like you would rubber stamp any of the mayor's proposals that come before the council.
Not at all. But for the first time in years, throughout even in the course of my all of my opponent's career, we have accountability. Finally, someone is being held accountable for what's going on in our schools. And my opponent voted against this accountability twice. She was only one. She was one of the two members of the council to vote against the mayor's takeover of the schools. I have yet to meet a voter in this primary who was against the mayor's takeover.
Councilmember Schwartz, you were one of the council members who opposed the mayor's takeover of the schools. How would you assess your working relationship with Mayor Adrian Fenty?
I think it's good, but I'm certainly not a rubber stamp for him or anybody else. I've always been a person who speaks out on the issues. There have been a lot of 12-to-1 votes on the council. I voted against the takeover. Adrian Fenty had actually voted against the takeover when Tony Williams, Mayor Williams, wanted to do it as well. And one of the reasons I did is because I felt that our only other elected body, the Board of Education, was going to be relegated to just an advisory state board of education, and that concerned me. I think we need more democracy in this town, not less. I do hope I'll get some opportunity to address the sick and safe leave. I think this is one of the most important things that the council has ever done, and I would love to. Could I take a moment now to talk about it? Actually, when the bill was first introduced by 26 organizations, I thought it was extreme, and I was actually the last person to sign onto it. All my colleagues had signed onto it. And it came to my committee. And so I worked with the advocates and I said, it's too extreme. It will be too hard on businesses. It required businesses of 5 or fewer employees to get 5 days a year, 6 or more employees. And we know with 6 employees, you're still a small business, had to give 10 days a year. And anyway, I worked for about 8 months in watering that bill down, dissipating it in so many ways, worked with the advocates, worked with the business community. In fact, the Chamber of Commerce, when we actually had our committee vote in December, which was 4-0, did Barbara Lang, the head of the Chamber of Commerce, sent out an email saying, "Happy holidays, everybody. We scored a tremendous victory with the council because they have compromised on that bill." So I had worked very closely with the business community.
So you're saying this demonstrates your ability to work with
exactly.
others.
Exactly. But after they had said, gotten all their concerns taken care of, and I continued to change that bill for the betterment of businesses for another 3 months, they turned. They turned and decided they were going to make this a big issue, and they were coming after me because of it. So my opponent has been the beneficiary, even though no one ever knew him before, of some anger with me. But let me tell you, when people work, we're not talking about people that are sitting home or walking the streets. We're talking about working people actually getting some small amount.
And obviously that's one of the reasons you're getting support from the SEIU. But there's a caller, Terry, on the line who wanted to ask Mr. Mara a question along similar lines about working with others. Terry, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks, Kojo. This is a great debate. I'm calling because I was wondering, Ms. Schwartz seems to be able to work with the other party to do what she just described. I was wondering how Mr. Mara, if he felt it would be more constructive to be a more combative voice on the council, which it appears he seems to indicate that would be his role, to be sort of a miserable minority as opposed to someone who would work with the Democrats. Because I can't conceive of the Republicans taking over the council. So wouldn't Ms. Schwartz be more effective in that role than you would be in a role?
Well, you heard Mr. Mara say earlier that he wants to be able to work with Mayor Fenty in order to reform the schools, but I guess he'd like to add something to that.
Absolutely. Certainly based on issue, when you take a look at the issues I'd work with people like Jack Evans, David Catania, even Marion Barry on parental choice and education. Few people know this, but he's one of the rare breeds on the council that supports our public charter school system, our voucher program, and homeschooling. And Ms. Schwartz is opposed to those things.
Oh,
getting back to sick and safe, what we didn't do in that situation, we did not look at the costs that would be associated with sick and safe. We didn't determine how many people will be laid off by sick and safe. How many people won't we hire due to sick and safe? How many businesses will relocate to Virginia or Maryland? How many businesses will not start up in the District of Columbia due to another unfunded mandate like sick and safe? And again, this is the only jurisdiction in America outside of San Francisco. We don't live in a vacuum. And Maryland and Virginia are right next door. Someone can just practically walk across the river and start up a business there. It's much easier to do. We have problems at DCRA with...
We're running out of time very, very quickly, and there are two issues that I think we need to get to. One of them has to do, of course, with the gun ban in the District of Columbia. Here's Ron in Washington. Ron, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I serve on the grand juries here in D.C., and most of the people are causing problems with guns are young kids from families that don't have fathers, and they're black here in D.C. So the gun ban is not even effective toward them, and I wanted to find out what position each of these candidates take on the gun ban.
A minute, Carol Swartz.
Listen, I grew up in Texas where my father had three guns. My husband had a grandfathered in gun, which I did not want in the house because of children, small children. My husband died by his own gun. I have always been sort of personally not in favor of a gun ban, but I knew the will of the District of Columbia voters, and they are in favor of a gun ban because of it having so adversely affected my life and because we know it can be used, your own gun can be used against you or children could get a gun. I support now the gun ban, but because of the Supreme Court decision, we do have to allow people to have guns, and we have abided by that Supreme Court decision.
Your position, Patrick Mara.
Sure. I think we need to get real here. As we all know, most or all crimes that have been committed with guns in recent years for the past 30 years have been done with illegal guns. And we need to throw the book at people who are using these guns illegally. With that said, with this new legislation, I had some concerns with the trigger lock. So I went out to Virginia. I actually visited a gun shop out in Virginia, and I saw the demonstration of the trigger locks. Now, in this Supreme Court decision, it said that people should have a right to defend themselves in their own home. In seeing this demonstration of the trigger locks, it was clear to me that people will not be able to defend themselves in their own home in enough time. In addition, people will also load the guns with ammunition and make them even more dangerous. I think that as a precondition for licensure, we will need to have safety and training classes. But at the same time, we do need to realize that people.
So you think the legislation needs to be revisited?
For safety and training classes. But what we're looking at now is another, more legal time, and it's just going to cost the district more money. So I think we need to take a closer look at the legislation.
Remind our listeners that the primary is on September 9th, and you mentioned get real here. A lot of political observers say getting real means that given the small number of Republicans in the District of Columbia, if Patrick Mara manages to defeat Carol Schwartz in the primary, we all know that there's a general election coming in November. And in that general election, you would be running against, on the Democratic side, of course, Kwame Brown is favored to be reelected. But the other candidate who you would be running against would be Michael Brown, who has run citywide for mayor before and is well known across the city. Carol Schwartz is well known across the city. Observers say, look, if Mara wins the primary, he doesn't have a prayer of winning the general. If, on the other hand, Schwartz wins the primary, she probably could take the general. How do you respond?
You know, Kojo, I do get this question every once in a while. I have visited thousands and thousands of homes across the district in every ward. I've been talking with voters in each and every ward about the issues. I'm getting out there. I'm interacting on a daily basis. The Republican has had the advantage to win this seat for the last 6 out of 7 cycles. This is a presidential election year. The Republican is guaranteed to receive 30,000 votes when you look down the ticket based on the number of voters who will vote for the Republican presidential nominee. In addition, I will have a tremendous bump from defeating my primary opponent, Ms. Schwartz, which will translate into earned media. And I will just continue to do what it is I'm doing now, talking about the spending on the council.
You think in that period of time you will be able to build the kind of name recognition between September and November that can surpass the name recognition that Carol Schwartz now has or the name recognition Michael Brown now has? I'm afraid we're just about out of time. We do have 30 seconds for each of you to make a final statement about what you would offer the voters. Carol Schwartz.
Well, I think you know what I offer, and that is more of the same, hard work, more of the same passion for this city, more of the same protectiveness of this city, and change for the better. I have been about change long before that word was used all the time. And everything I've touched, whether it be the school board in the 70s, where the test scores actually went up, check the record, whether it be the 80s, where I warned against financial disaster and it happened, coming back and helping cause financial stability. I do, Kojo, need to tell you, I support charter schools. I support homeschooling. This is the kind of misleading statements that keep being made. Sick and Safe Now takes care of the small business. It's now only 3 days, 5 days, 7 days, and that means if you're a part-time worker, 1.5 days.
Kojo,
and what is wrong with
my
people
opponent,
being
one,
able
one second,
to be sick and still get paid?
Here is your 30 seconds.
Thank
with
you.
A couple of extra thrown in.
Kojo, I'm 33 years old. My opponent has been in office since before I was born. During that time, the schools have been an absolute wreck. During that time, budgets have increased rapidly. Just in the last 4 years alone, in this past term on the council, as I said before, up 51%. These two factors are forcing people out of the district, and we are discouraging new people from moving into the district. These two issues, in addition to public safety, are the three issues that I will focus on most in an effort to bring a change to the council and to offer a new voice to the council.
Patrick Mara is the challenger in the Republican primary on September 9th for the at-large city council seat. Thank you for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Carol Schwartz is the incumbent Republican at-large member of the D.C. City Council. She's the chairperson of the Committee on Workforce Development and Government Operations. She seeks re-election in the September 9th primary. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo.
And
appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with architect Roger Lewis about where politics and architecture intersect. I'm Kojo Nam.
This is WAMU 88.5. I'm Matt McCleskey. At 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More from NPR News.
In 1961, theatergoers were introduced to the Exiles.
What follows is the authentic account of 12 hours in the lives of a group of Indians who have come to Los Angeles, California.
Now, a restored version of the film brings this Native American story to a new audience. I'm Lynn Neary. Join us as we discuss with filmmakers and a participant why The Exiles still resonates nearly a half century later. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock. Then at 3, it's Fresh Air.
On the next Fresh Air, our week of interviews about presidential history and politics continues. We'll hear from press secretaries representing each president from Ronald Reagan through George W. Bush, and they'll talk about some of the tough spots they've been in. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
That's Fresh Air coming up at 3 o'clock today here on WAMU 88.5.
I'm David First, host of Metro Connection, inviting you to join WAMU 88.5's The Conversation. Our social network allows you to connect with other listeners, launch discussions about news you heard on WAMU 88.5. Plus, we have quick links to many of our daily reports and programs, allowing you to catch up with your favorite programs on your schedule. More information is at conversation.wamu.org.
It's 80 degrees in Northwest Washington at 1236 as the Kojo Namdi Show continues.
You know, when Roger Lewis went to architecture school a few decades ago, no doubt he took classes in topics like design, calculus, and art. But after decades spent in Washington, D.C., he probably regrets not taking more classes in political science or conflict mediation. After all, politics permeates our environment in profound ways, affecting which buildings make it off the drawing board and which get gummed up by advisory commissions, political infighting, and zoning wars. Architecture also serves as a unique document of our political history, of who has power and who doesn't, and why some neighborhoods get bulldozed and others don't. Roger Lewis is architect and a columnist, the Shaping the City column for the Washington Post. He's professor emeritus of architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. Roger, good to have you back.
Thank you for inviting me back.
You know, Washington's built environment looks profoundly different than it did 20 or 50 years ago. And in some ways, our architecture reflects our political history, who wields power and who doesn't. For instance, 50 years ago, neighborhoods in southwest Washington were mostly bulldozed. Thousands of families were forced to relocate, and the entire feel of a neighborhood was transformed. That's a pretty extreme example of what politics, or really lack of political clout, can lead to, isn't it?
Indeed. I think that it demonstrates the problem when the political clout is not housed among the residents of such neighborhoods. It's the old story. It seemed like a good idea at the time.
Tell our listeners who may not be aware of what happened in Southwest.
Well, the Southwest Urban Renewal Area, some call it the urban removal movement of American urban development, but after World War II, there was a substantial commitment of political will and money to trying to get rid of a lot of urban neighborhoods that were considered dysfunctional, not just in Washington. This was a national priority. And the powers that be, the political leadership of both federal and district,
which in those days was basically the same.
The same, basically the same. And Congress was even closer to running things than they are now. This neighborhood of Southwest Washington, even though it was, in fact, a neighborhood that had been there for more than a century, there were buildings there that were today would be preserved. You wouldn't even think of demolishing them. But it was a place with people who were relatively poor economically, who had very little political clout, were not seen as important, if you will, in the political landscape. And here was this place that looked derelict, that looked like it needed to be resurrected in some way. So they said, "Oh, let's clear it, slum clearance. Let's clear it and build something new." And if you go and drive around Southwest today, you can see, even if you don't know a whole lot about the history, you can see it looks different than Capitol Hill, looks different than Georgetown, looks different than a lot of neighborhoods in Washington.
And in those days, that was taught, it is my understanding, in architecture school as best practices.
Well, I remember I was an architecture student in the early 60s when much of the Southwest was being redesigned. I remember reading the architectural journals and seeing pictures of the project by eminent architects. It looked like a good idea at the time. It seemed to be, without much profound thought behind it, where we were headed, that we were going to go through the cities of America and get rid of all of these slums and ghettos and whatever noun or adjective you want to apply to them. There was absolutely no concern for whether this was a good idea for the people who lived there. Where were they going to go? There was no substitute or replacement housing being provided, and there was almost no attention being paid to the, if you will, the architectural and historic value of the structures themselves.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. How do you think politics has affected the look of the neighborhood that you live in? 800-433-8850, or you can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Roger, today there's a huge debate in D.C. about a possible soccer stadium and other developments along Poplar Point in Southeast. Do the terms of that debate differ significantly from the redevelopment of Southwest?
I think so. I mean, I believe Poplar Point is a good part of the city to talk about, because here's a place, it's open space, it's parkland, it's publicly owned. It was federal. I think a good part of it, if not all of it, I don't know the exact dimensions, has been transferred to the District of Columbia. They have solicited proposals for its development, which include the possibility of a soccer stadium, but a lot of other things, commercial, residential, that would, in fact, be of benefit to those folks who live on the east side of the Anacostia River. But the issue now is, first of all, what is the right thing to do there? There is debate. There's open public debate about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea to bring a soccer stadium there. Who would benefit? Who would be winners and who would be losers? There is clearly much more sensitivity, I think, in the 21st century and the latter part of the 20th century. There's much more sensitivity by politicians and others to, in fact, public sentiment and to the people who are going to be affected by these kinds of interventions. So that's a big change. I mean, the top-down approach is no longer viable, although occasionally what the top wants gets done. So we shouldn't overlook the fact that even though it starts at the top, it may or may not be blocked by those who are not at the top.
Is that something that today's architecture student needs to be aware of, that we're living in a more politically sensitive time, so that even though you're learning a certain kind of skill here, that you also ought to be aware that when you start to practice the skill in the real world, especially if it comes to participating in large developments, that you have to be aware of and sensitive to community feelings about issues?
I think so. I mean, we don't necessarily spend a huge number of credit hours at universities teaching students the art of negotiation. I always love one of my wife's favorite books is a book called Getting to Yes. My wife's an attorney, so I can attribute that to her. I think architecture students and planning students and people who deal with the development of cities and towns and suburbs are much more aware than they were 30 or 40 years ago, certainly when I was a student, of the need to work the political street. There are many architectural theoreticians who've said any building at all is political, is a political act. It's political because in D.C., for example, when you build a building, you are complying with a zoning ordinance. A zoning ordinance is a legislative manifestation of policy. So you can easily collect the dots and show that public policy, political thinking, what gets built, where it gets built, when it gets built, those are connected. They are not independent.
You say that zoning is a very blunt tool to try to either preserve or change the feel of a built environment. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't want to get too bogged down in what zoning is. Most people probably know that zoning is law that regulates the use of land, what you can put on it, the density with which such development can occur. It mandates what yards or setbacks you have to provide, what the height restrictions are. It, in most jurisdictions, says how much parking you have to provide on site. But it doesn't design the building. It doesn't in any way guarantee, in fact, that you'll get good architecture. And I should add that another goal of zoning traditionally has been to protect neighborhood property values, because you don't want someone to come build a rendering plant next to your home. In fact, zoning traditionally has been used primarily as a separator. It's to segregate land uses. And if you look at America's urban landscape, you'll see, unlike many cities in other parts of the world, that we have separated land uses. The problem is zoning is primarily used today to do just that. It's to separate and to protect, as opposed to proactively make certain things happen that the body politic might want to happen. So it's not affecting design the way we now believe design should be effectuated. It doesn't do enough. It's not prescriptive enough in some areas, and it's too flexible in other areas.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Roger Lewis. He's the Professor Emeritus of Architecture at the University of Maryland College Park, and the columnist, the Shaping the City columnist with the Washington Post. If you'd like to call us, 800-433-8850 is the number to call. How do you see politics affecting neighborhoods and the look of neighborhoods in the Washington area? I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Coming up at 1, should 19-year-olds drink? What's behind a controversial proposal by college presidents who say a 21-year-old drinking age causes more problems than it solves? Plus, as autism diagnoses rise, we look at new tests designed to spot autism in babies as young as 9 months old. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nnamdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Then at 2 o'clock, it's Tell Me More.
In 1961, theatergoers were introduced to the Exiles.
What follows is the authentic account of 12 hours in the lives of a group of Indians who have come to Los Angeles, California.
Now, a restored version of the film brings this Native American story to a new audience. I'm Lynn Neary. Join us as we discuss with filmmakers and a participant why The Exiles still resonates nearly a half century later. Next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock today here on WAMU 88.5. Tomorrow afternoon at 1 on Metro Connection, now it's even easier to meet up with local growers. The Maryland Online Farmers Market aims to connect buyers and sellers with local food as soon as it's harvested. We'll hear about that on Metro Connection tomorrow afternoon at 1 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Wolf Trap, presenting the Broadway musical Les Miserables on stage Sunday, August 29th through Sunday, September 7th, with evening and matinee performances. Tickets at 877-WOLF-TRAP or online at wolftrap.org.
Welcome back. We're talking with Roger Lewis. He's an architect. He's the Shaping the City columnist for the Washington Post and Professor Emeritus of Architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. Sometimes it seems, Roger, like community activists throw around the concept of historic preservation, and it's really a bit disingenuous. Tell us a little bit about the Northwest neighborhood of Cleveland Park, where there's a shopping center known as Park and Shop, which is historically noteworthy as the first strip mall in the city. Back in the 1980s, there was a plan to redesign that site based on ideas that today, I guess, we would associate with smart growth. What happened?
Well, that's a very good summary. Park and Shop, which is across the street from the Uptown Theater on Connecticut Avenue, was built about 60 years ago, 70 years ago, and is considered one of the earliest examples of a commercial development, a strip development along a major road where you drive in and park your car in front and walk in and do whatever shopping you have to do. The property also happens to be sitting right next to a metro station. And the owner of the property, and the city for that matter, thought that this one-story L-shaped Art Deco shopping building really wasn't the right use for that property in the 1980s and beyond, especially given the transit stop. So the owner of the property proposed undertaking development that would have demolished the building and would have greatly intensified the use of the property. There were serious objections to this, though. Some people objected to changing anything. You will always have that. There were many people living in Cleveland Park who didn't want to see any change at all. There were others who were very worried about, for different reasons, but who were worried about the fact that this would bring more traffic. That is, if you went from this one-story, fairly low-intensity use to a multi-story building with offices and retail and other things, this would add traffic, this would congest the streets, the parking would become a problem. And then there were those who said, wait a minute, this is a piece of the architectural and cultural heritage of the city of Washington. We ought to save it. And there were people who felt very strongly about that. Ultimately, a decision had to be made, and the decision was to save this building. That is to say, the political forces, the people in the neighborhood, the citizens of the district working with the historic preservation community succeeded in this case at preventing that shopping center from being demolished. So it has been fixed up, it's been remodeled, and sits there to this day on a site that, if frankly, from a from an urban design, urban economics point of view, is greatly underutilized.
There's a paradox at play here. Empowered communities have the power to throw more monkey wrenches, you know, into a project like this. From a design perspective, is there a danger of having too many cooks in the kitchen? Is that what we had here?
Well, I'm not sure it's a cooks in the kitchen problem. I mean, architects often talk about how if you put too many cooks in the kitchen, instead of a horse, you get a camel. I don't think it was a design issue, although there was great anxiety. I should add this. There was great anxiety also that having looked at so many ugly developments in the city of Washington, big commercial buildings that no one particularly loved, you know, you can point to buildings on K Street that everybody would wishes would go away. So there was some anxiety about what the results would be if that building, if that stop and the parking shop had been torn down and new development put in place. I don't think it was an issue of too many cooks in that case. I do think there are other cases you can point to where there has been public and political opposition to something in which there were so many different opinions. It was hard to reach consensus, and I think most politicians are reluctant to go out on a limb if they don't sense some degree of consensus about a project.
Can political resistance be overcome by good architecture? I don't know why I'm thinking here of the Martin Luther King Library, even as we speak, which is supposed to be an architectural symbol in the District of Columbia, but which there's a major political brouhaha right now over demolishing it and replacing it with something else. Again, the question, can that resistance to tearing that building down be overcome by a really brilliant architectural concept?
It could be. I mean, I think that the significance of the building is not that it's the greatest architecture, but that it is
who designed it.
It's designed by Mies van der Rohe, who was a very, very well-known, famous 20th century American German architect who came to America. One could argue that if someone showed a way of preserving that building and also solving the problems that the people who want to change or get rid of the building point to, then you have a win-win situation. I mean, that's what getting to yes is all about. Again, I've always pointed to the near where we're sitting right now.
The
Best Buy with the new
on Wisconsin Avenue.
Apartment sitting on the top. A very skillfully done piece of work. I think almost everybody I know recognizes that it was well done. It could have been done poorly. And you want to get a very good cook into the kitchen. And I think they had a very good cook. They had a good architect do the job. They did a very good job. I think that same strategy could work at the MLK Library because I think the building is worth preserving, but I think it needs to be changed. It needs things done to it within it, and it could easily become the podium or the base for something built on top of it.
Well, what Bush 41 President George Herbert Walker Bush used to call the vision thing. By the 1990s, we began to see political leaders becoming champions of certain types of development, the Verizon Center, the Convention Center. To what extent can political leadership implant a vision that becomes acceptable to the various, usually competing parties for a development?
Well, those are two very good examples. I've always said there are two kinds of political leaders: those who lead from the front, they have the flag and they charge the, at the front of the public, and then there are those who lead from the back, who wait to see where the public wants to go.
Finger to the wind.
Exactly, and I've worked with both kinds of political leaders. I mean, you mentioned the Verizon Center and the Convention Center; these were clearly projects that happened as the result of leadership. People at the top, if you will, of the political construct, wanting to make these things happen. I don't think I think if you'd gone into the Shaw neighborhood, and taken a poll and had nothing but just the opinion of the neighbors, and you said, "Well, we'd like to insert a four-block-long building in here," I don't think anybody would have voted for that.
There was a lot of opposition.
They would have questioned. And the Verizon Center, they had to close a part of G Street, part of the L'Enfant Plan pattern. There was tremendous opposition from the historic preservation community about just suddenly dropping a building on top of a piece of this this very, very sacred part of Washington's history, the L'Enfant Plan. You couldn't build the Verizon Center unless you closed G Street between 6th and 7th. And again, it happened because the political leaders were willing to go forward with that despite the opposition. And there were people who were in favor. And, of course, that's when the political leaders are put on the spot, is when you've got not so clear a consensus and they have to make a decision. And in that case, the political leadership, along with business interests, private interests, they said, this is a good idea. We think this is good for the city. We're going to do it. So that those are two good examples of that happening.
There seems to be an inherent tension between forward-thinking ideas about smart growth and historic buildings, which perhaps deserve to be preserved for their noteworthy design, but also exhibit features that some might call dumb growth. How do you resolve
that? Yeah, well, historic preservation can be based on architectural qualities, but it can also be based on cultural and historic characteristics that may have nothing to do with what the building looks like. I mean, the Park and Shop on Connecticut Avenue is not a great piece of architecture. Its significance lies elsewhere. I think we're always going to have that problem before us, and I think there's no one-size-fits-all answer to that. I think in every case you have to take it case by case, analyze the benefits, weigh them against the costs. I know no one likes to hear the old cost-benefit conundrum, but that's what it's about. What do I lose if I do something? What do I gain? And it requires some judgment being exercised.
One of the things I like about these conversations is that they are taking place even as we look at what's likely to develop along Poplar Point. We look at what's likely to develop where the old convention center was. And so we'll have Roger Lewis along to comment on those even as they start being built. Roger, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me again.
Roger Lewis is an architect. He's the Shaping the City columnist for the Washington Post and professor emeritus of architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Up tomorrow on the Politics Hour, the latest buzz from the Richmond rumor mill. With Obama in Virginia again, we look at what's being said about potential running mates from our region. Plus, construction workers and kindergartners are waiting. What projects are still undone as students head back to school? The Politics Hour, tomorrow at noon on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. The second hour of today's Kojo Nandi Show is coming up next here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Washington City Paper. Their education issue, available this Friday on newsstands, explores the inside